I want to take this opportunity of this talk to look deeper at this theme of love and the lover, which is what we're exploring this week. Now I'm going to start with Subhuti. About just under a year ago, Subhuti was here at Padmaloka giving a series of talks that have since been described as fairly seminal on the great stages of spiritual practice. And in the context of this talk, it was one of the great themes that emerged was a love, and even as Subhuti and Padmavajra were discussing it, love as eros, love as powerful love. And they're actually leading going to follow up this theme this year at Adisthana. So it seems very apt also that this retreat is sort of, there's something in the air around the movement and the order at the moment to do with this theme. So I'm going to spring off some words that Subhuti says in his lecture on spiritual receptivity. Great stage of spiritual receptivity. So this is what he says, and I'm slightly paraphrasing. Subhuti's wanting to go off on all sorts of tangents and jokes, but sometimes you have to cut those out to get to the point. So Subhuti says, faith is craving directed towards something that hints at the transcendental. You could speak of karma tanha, longing desire for sense experience, and dharma tanha, longing desire for the Dharma. They are actually the same magnetic power, but in the latter case, that magnetic power is going towards something that glints of the Dharma. This is the powerful attraction whereby instinctual drives become transcended in faith. So this is right up my street. Now the words there, Arya Priya mentioned them in his talk, the Pali words there. We have karma tanha and dharma tanha. These are the words Subhuti mentioned. Karma, not in the sense of karma, as in action or volition, but karma as in sense. So karma, tanha. Tanha is the word the Buddha used to describe this deep sense of longing, this deep sense of desire. It's the second of his noble truths. It means, the metaphor is thirst, thirsting after tanha. Really, particularly in India, in such a hot climate, thirst is something you really feel strongly on a daily basis. So he used this word to really talk to men's chests, if you will, to evoke this this deep thirsting after. So he has these two types: karma tanha, thirsting after sense impressions, and dharma tanha, or thirsting after the truth. So again, you could speak of karma tanha, longing desire for sense experience, and dharma tanha, longing desire for the Dharma. And he says they are actually the same magnetic power, but in the latter, i.e. dharma tanha, that magnetic power is going towards something that glints truly of the Dharma. So this quote is what I want to explore, this theme of them being the same magnetic power, but qualitatively different depending on the objects they're directed towards, whether they're directed towards sense impressions or directed to something transcendental, something like the truth, the Dharma. And it seems to be that This tanha that the Buddha spoke of is the fundamental nature of our experience. Our fundamental experience of life is characterized by yearning. Most of the time we experience this in petty cravings, just these superficial cravings of, I fancy this, don't fancy that, rather not now, ooh, what's that? But really these petty cravings are like ripples. They're ripples from something much deeper going on inside our nature, something hardly even conscious. And it seems that this is, well, I think this is our existential situation, this state of deep thirsting. You could say it's our nature. I wonder even if it is nature itself, if that is nature's defining characteristic, this urging, this yearning, longing and looking. So we're yearning, and the implication is that it's as if we're missing something, and that we're looking for something to satiate this thirst. We're looking for something to fill us up. And this seems to be an eternal theme. Notably, I find it interesting that the word religion comes from the word religiare, which means to reconnect with. Religiare. Ligiare is in like ligament, the connecting things. So it's as if this men's religious nature is this quest, this looking, this searching for something to reach, to reconnect with, something that will fill us up, something that will we can bond with. That will satiate something that's missing, something that's not there or not fully there. I was reading some work by Jung recently, the psycho naught. And one of the things that struck me is he notes that in so many cultures you have this myth of the fall. This myth of there was a state when things were full, a state when things were whole, and that then things fell from there. And he charts this in all different kinds of cultures. Of course, we have it in Christianity, you have it in Buddhist culture and legends as well. A state where something was okay, and then something happened, and we lost something. We lost something. Something went missing. Disciples of Jung have gone on to sort of equate this with, they sort of psychoanalytically explain this as the trauma of birth, as in we're all connected to another human being, literally, through our stomachs, through our bellies, and that the trauma of birth is like the fall, and we've worked that out as a big myth. Who knows? I don't know if that's where it comes from. But yeah, this urge to reconnect, this urge to refill that which is missing. I was quite struck by this interpretation of the fall as being the trauma of birth, of being connected to another human being. I was thinking about it, and again, thinking about this theme of love and eros. I have in my longings and sexual fantasies for women. Often it is the sort of connection and security of a woman's breast, which I most often visits me. It's not really a kind of living out of a relationship or even full copulation. It's actually just the sort of the security and connection and the warmth of a bosom, actually. I sort of noticed that when I heard about this interpretation. And of course, I couldn't help feeling, well, it's infantile. It's like a child wanting to be protected, to be secure. And I think it is actually infantile. But it is there. But it is there. We do. I think I, for one, and I don't think I'm alone. You know, there's a deep yearning for that security or connection, which maybe was once met in that way by another human being, our mother. But of course, that's gone. And looking for it in a lover, I'm increasingly not convinced that works, or that I will find what I'm looking for there. I won't find it in the bosoms of my lovers. But the search does go on, of course. So it's like, where do you start looking then? The urge is still there. The urge is still true, but we need something. Need something better. Need a better place of security, a better place of connection. So it's as if we're missing something. It's as if something we're not. Something is missing. Something is amiss in this situation. I struck also in this connection with the Buddha's vision of dukkha. So, as you know, the Buddha's first truth is that of dukkha, that life is characterized by dukkha. That's one of the marks of existence, the truth of dukkha. Dukkha is sometimes rendered as suffering, which in itself is a dissatisfying translation, because it's more than that. Suffering is one aspect of dukkha, but dukkha is actually something far more inspiring, far more deep than mere suffering, in a sense. The word is again another metaphor. It's another image the Buddha is evoking. Apparently, it means ill-fitting axle, dukkha. And so, again, you have this image of an axle, a wheel, and the axle doesn't quite fit right. So the wheel is rolling, but it's not rolling perfectly. It's sort of bumpy. And again, the wheel is the circle is the paradigmatic image of wholesomeness, of perfection, of fullness. Yet, with this axle not fitting quite, it's bumping. It's almost like there's a glitch in the circle. Again, something's missing from the shape of the axle, the shape of the wheel, which doesn't make things roll right, doesn't make things full. Something's missing. So it is this search for wholeness, I think, which we can characterize as spiritual life, Dharma life, a search for fulfillment, a search for perfection. And again, it's also noticeable that holy life, again, the word is related to the word whole, not whole as in holes in my socks, but whole as in complete. So, the holy life. What is it? Well, we most of the time these days have to look back to the ancients to get a sense of what the holy life looks like. So today will be no exception, and that's where we're going to go. So first of all, as Sanghanista mentioned on the first evening, and as Jeremy evoked yesterday, we have this episode in history where the Buddha famously says that spiritual life is friendship. Friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. Holy life is spiritual friendship. Friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. And if you've been around the Triratna community for any time, you will have heard this statement many, many times. Of course, Sangharakshita has very much emphasized the importance of friendship in our community for all sorts of interesting reasons. And you will hear it over and over again. In fact, we hear it so much that I want to go into it a little bit more deeply, just to see what the Buddha actually says. So the scenario comes from a sutta wherein the Buddha is, as he customarily does, wandering around with Ananda. And often when you're reading suttas, this scenario can often tell you all sorts of wonderful things in themselves, not just what the explicit content of the sutta is, but the scenario. So you've got the Buddha with Ananda spending time together, and this has always been something that struck me about Buddhist stories, Buddhist texts. Last year, I was in India with Subhuti, and we visited a place of pilgrimage called Vulture's Peak, which is in northern eastern India, in Bihar. We travelled from Bodh Gaya, the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, out towards Rajgriha and Vulture's Peak. And one of the things I was really struck by on this journey is, A, the fact that after the Buddha's enlightenment, he got up and went out looking for his friends, which is quite an... Apparently, Vajratara is telling me that's quite a strange thing for Indian gurus to do. Normally they have a revelation and they wait for people to come. But so it's quite striking in itself that the Buddha went out looking for his friends. And then he spent most of his time at this place called Vulture's Peak, which is this rocky sort of mountain crop over a large dusty valley. And as we went to Vulture's Peak, it's been a place of pilgrimage for thousands of years, and it's full of caves. It's actually the place where the Buddhist community used to dwell quite a lot of the time. And what I was struck with when we visited Vulture's Peak was just this sense of men living and dwelling together for a long time, like a lifetime. Or even lifetimes, a real community of people, not just having a good, you know, remember that time, you know, that was great, that was a peak, but actually living together for a long, long time. The caves sort of course, now they're full of oil and soot and stuff, but they felt full of life, they felt full of stories, real human stories of men living together over a long period of time. Talking about the Dharma, working it out together, and people coming and going from these places. It's a really fabulous place, quite a simple place, but at the top of Vulture's Peak, which is often the setting for many of these fantastic Mahayana sutras, sort of the top of the world. Vulture's Peak, vulture being the bird that flies the highest. It's a very simple little shrine. It's just a wall, basically. It's just a little walled area. But people come from all over the world to pay homage to this site. And, yeah, it really is sort of slightly outside this world. Anyway, so that's what to speak. And, yeah, so when I read this sutta, I think of these men dwelling together over a long time, rediscussing the Dharma, reevaluating it, coming up with fresh ways in. So, as you know, the Ananda's been off thinking about the Dharma and comes back to the Buddha and says, you know, Lord, I've had a great insight. He's full of beans, and he says, I've seen that spiritual friendship is half the holy life. And the Buddha responds by correcting him. So I'm going to read the Pali because I like hearing the Pali. I like it's a sort of a bit of an echo of what he said. It's just a sentence. It's a famous sentence. So he says, "Ma hevam Ananda, ma hevam Ananda." Sakala mevidam Ananda, brahmacharyam yadidam, kalyana mitata, kalyana sahayata, kalyana sampavankata. That's what he says. So he says, yeah, Mayavam Ananda, say not so, Ananda, say not so. This spiritual life, Ananda, is Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship, companionship, and comradeship. The word he uses for spiritual life here, again, spiritual, is such a crude translation of many of the words that the Buddha would have actually used. He says brahmacharyam here, brahmacharya. The Brahma means high, it means highest, it means godly, holy, the godly life. This ordination is a dharmachari ordination, charya meaning faring or coursing in. So sometimes the Buddha will talk about brahmacharya, the way of the divine, the way of the godly, the high life. or dharmacharyas, they could be synonyms. So then these three words, the other word that we translate as spiritual is this word Kalyana, and it doesn't mean spiritual really either. Kalyana means something more like beautiful, something true, something lovely or good. So something beautiful, I think, is probably the most apt, most compelling translation for me, at least. So yeah, beautiful friendship, beautiful companionship, beautiful comradeship, or beautiful communion. This is one of the words, this is one of the translations I like. Beautiful communion is the whole of the spiritual life. But there is an ambiguity in these words of the Buddha. These words are ambiguous. And of course that's no mistake at all. The Buddha, it seems like the Buddha was often, could be ambiguous. He used irony and humor. He uses all kinds of metaphor for implicit meanings. He's a living man with a living vital teaching. Just in the same way that, I don't know, you know, how Sangharakshita can be ambiguous and even cheeky with some of his teachings. And remember, in this instance, the Buddha talking to one man. He's not talking to an assembly. He's talking to one person. So we don't know exactly what he's trying to say to Ananda, but he's saying something that's certainly useful to Ananda. So the ambiguity is not a mistake. At the same time, the Buddha could also be very clear. You know, sometimes people sort of complain about Buddhism as being contradictory or too mystical. But the Buddha is also very, very clear at times what he's saying. You know, if he's talking about hatred, for instance, he can be emphatically clear. Or if he's talking about non-fixed nature, he can be, again, emphatically explicit about what he literally means. But yeah, he also enjoys ambiguity and humor, irony. So in this instance, there is an ambiguity. And the ambiguity is this. So we have the literal meaning, of course, of spiritual life is, the whole of the spiritual life is friendship, is beautiful friendship. But the other meaning is, the whole of the spiritual life is friendship in the beautiful. Friendship in the beautiful. Or if we use this word communion, communion with the beautiful. So to explore this aspect of Kalyana Mitrata, I'm going to recourse to a different discourse. So I want to look at another discourse, a different sutta, to try and get a better sense of, because that one stops there, pretty much. That one stops there. He still leaves it ambiguous. So let's look at another one to better explore this idea of what friendship in the beautiful could mean. So I want to leave behind these, we're leaving behind these two friends in this dusty wood, and I want to travel west, roughly about the same time, maybe a few generations later, to a different discourse that's taking place, not amongst a pair of friends, but a group of friends, and this time in a house, in a big house, in Agathon's house. I want to go to Athens. So I want to go to Athens, where a party is taking place. A party known as a symposium. So I want to look at something in Plato's Symposium. After all, you can't really give a feature-length talk on love in Europe without referencing the Symposium, which is probably the most influential treatise on love ever written in European culture. And funny reading the Symposium, it reads like a Mahayana Sutra, in a way. It reads like that. I'm not saying it is that, but it reads sort of like that. It's a drama that takes place with various people coming in and offering their take, their ideas on a certain theme. In fact, I was thinking it's sort of like this event we're having here. What happens at a symposium is a group of guys get together and they spend an evening together with a host. So, Sanganissa, you can be our Agathon. And the host decides a theme for the evening. And they decide, do we want to drink or do we not want to drink? So at this one, I think they are drinking. They decide, do we want prostitutes and dancers? And this one, they decided not. I don't know, I presume. So they decide on the theme. Agathon says, let's talk about love tonight. And let's talk seriously, which is why they tell all the dancers to go. And then what happens is everyone takes turns to stand up and they give a speech on love, just as we're doing here. So at the climax of the piece, Socrates gets up, and Socrates is the guru, and so I'm going to head straight to the juncular. There's been all sorts of funny stories, very readable, but now I'm just going to head straight towards what Socrates says at the climax of the piece. And just a little bit of background, these men, they're concerned with the issue of immortality. They want immortality. They want the deathless. That's the theme. That's one of the themes of the retreat, of the symposium. And they're using this language of being pregnant. Socrates has been talking about men who are pregnant in body and pregnant in mind. And by this, he means potential. He means the potential to bring about things. So he's been talking about there are men who are pregnant in body and want to give birth to things, buildings, cities, suns, material things, corporal things, the body. So they want to give birth to stuff, and that's how they're going to make their mark in eternity. That's how they're going to achieve immortality. There's my monument, there's my sons or the stuff they leave behind after their death. And then he says, so in a way that could be connected to karma, like I was talking earlier, like the karma, tanha, sense, is stuff. And the other type he's talking about is men who are pregnant in mind, and who want to give birth to what we might call spiritual things, knowledge, virtue, wisdom. Again, this maps to our notion of Dharma Tanha, or the realm of the Dharma. And the whole structure of their thinking is very much one of assent. So he's not saying men who are pregnant in body are bad or wrong. That's not the worldview. It's not like that's the wrong way. In Socrates' view, that's a lower way. It's not wrong. It's a sliding scale of ascent. It's a scale of ascent, a scale of sublimation. You could say, where these lower endeavors, lower urges, are moving towards higher endeavors and urges. And this is very much so. It's a model of development, and it's clear that Buddhism is a developmental model. Again, I remember Subhuti saying recently that there is no non-developmental model in Buddhism. There is always a path of progress. There's a path. Anyway, for Plato, the model is always ascent, going higher and higher and higher. So, with that in mind, I'll take you towards the end of this drama. This is one of the set pieces where Socrates has been called to the floor. He's giving his speech, and he's talking. He says he's heard his speech from a goddess called Diotima, who visited him in some kind of dream or vision or something, and she's revealed to him the mysteries of love. So I'll start, and I'm going to read you the final section. So she says, "Even you, Socrates, could perhaps be initiated in the rites of love I've described so far." That's sort of the body and all that. But for the purpose of these rites, if they are performed correctly, is to reach the final vision of the mysteries. And I'm not sure you could manage this. But I'll tell you about them. And as I do, make every effort in doing so. Try to follow as far as you can. Try to concentrate. Anyone who has this far been educated in the ways of love, viewing beautiful things in the right order, will now reach the goal of love's ways. He will suddenly catch sight of something amazingly beautiful in its nature. This, Socrates, is the ultimate objective of all the previous efforts. First, this beauty always is, and does not come into being or cease. It does not increase or diminish. It's not beautiful in one respect or ugly in another, or beautiful at one time, but not at another, or beautiful in relation to this, but not in relation to that, nor beautiful here and ugly there. It is not beautiful for some and ugly for others. Nor will this beauty appear in the form of a face or hands or any part of the body, or as a specific piece of knowledge, or as being anywhere in something, not in a living creature or earth or heaven or anywhere else. It will appear as in itself and by itself, always single in form. All other things share in its character. But do so in such a way that when things come to be or cease, it is not increased or decreased in any way, nor does it undergo any change. When someone goes up by these stages and begins to catch sight of this beauty, he has come close to reaching the goal. This is the right method of approaching the ways of love, or being loved by someone else. beginning with beautiful things and going up to the aim of beauty itself. Like someone using a staircase, he should go from one to two, from two to all beautiful bodies, and from beautiful bodies to beautiful practices, from beautiful practices to beautiful forms of learning. From forms of learning, he should end up at that form of learning, which is none other than beauty itself. In that form of life, my dear Socrates, said the stranger, if in any human life should be lived, gazing on beauty itself, if ever you saw that, it would seem to be on a different level from the gold and cloths of beautiful people, beautiful women and young men. At present, you're so overwhelmed when you see these that you're ready, together with so many others, to look at your girlfriends and be with them forever, as if that somehow were possible, doing without food and drink and doing nothing but gazing on them and being with them. So what should we imagine it would be like, she said, if someone could see beauty itself, absolute, pure, unmixed, not cluttered up with human flesh and colours and a great mass of mortal rubbish, but if he could catch sight of divine beauty itself in its single form, do you think, she said, that it would be a poor life for a human being, looking in that direction and gazing at the object with the right part of his mind and sharing in its company? Don't you realize, she said, that it's in that kind of life, when someone sees beauty with the part that can see it, that he'll be able to give birth not just to images of virtue, but to true virtue. It's someone who's given birth to true virtue and brought it up who has the chance of becoming loved by the gods and immortal. So that's what she says. Yeah, you see what I mean about this sort of flight, and I mean, there's so many comparisons one could draw with many other texts. So at this point, I think it's worth asking if we're any clearer about what love is. And probably the answer is maybe not. But in a sense, clearness is also about having the space to reevaluate, to clearing away stale notions of what love is, or what it could be, or what friendship is, or what it might be. Being interested to explore it further. And I'm not sure if it can really be... Would you really want it to be explained? Would you really want it to be pinned down? Arya Priya was telling me he looked up the etymology of this word adamantine, and as in this adamantine bond, love being an adamantine bond, and found out that it comes from the word adamastos, which again, Greek, in this world, means something like untamable. Untamable, wild, as if in its very nature, this bond, if ever it's there, cannot be pinned down. It cannot be tamed. It is wild, and a wild thing is not fully understandable even. That said, I will give one last pop at what love could be. So this is a secret, and it's a secret Padmavajra told the order on the convention last summer. So seeing as he's not here, I thought I could share it with everyone. So Padmavajra gave a really quite astounding talk on serving the great love last summer, which is really worth, I'm not sure if it's available, but if it is, it's really worth following up. And as part of that talk, he made this epic and, again, somewhat enigmatic statement about what love really is. He said, love is cosmos. Love is cosmos. I was struck with this at the time. I was sort of thinking, what on earth is he talking about? But in order to give a flavour of this, I'll tell you now just a recent experience I had. Last month I went on solitary retreat to Guquiloca. It's our place in Spain, this huge wild Spanish mountain valley. It's where men go to undergo the rite of ordination and ordination training. So I went back there, and they also have solitary facilities where you can go and spend time alone. And I was there for 2 weeks, and after a few days the retreat started to bite, as they do, literally after about three nights. And my usual hindrances are more in the of the kama, tanha type, sensual craving, lusting, food, music. But suddenly I was just overtaken with doubt and fear, which I hadn't really experienced in this way before. So I was doing my practices, I was doing my meditation practice, and I was just getting more and more doubtful and fearful of sort of, am I doing this right? That's how it started. It started, how am I doing this right? Moved on to sort of, I can't do this. I can't do this. I'm not good enough. Moved on from there to, what the hell is this anyway? And finally sort of mushroomed into this great big, what am I doing here? how did I end up here? Hold on a minute. I sort of rolled over into, that's right, that's what happened. I was sitting in front of my shrine, and just as I was coming out of my meditation, both my candles went out. Which is a bit cheeky. And so, of course, I was flung into this terrible fear, this darkness, this sort of fear of the dark. Completely irrational. Not totally irrational. There are warthogs at Guquiloca, but fairly irrational. And no electricity. So I rolled over onto my bed, and I started thinking, okay, well, what am I doing here? I don't know how I got here, but what the hell is anyone else doing? So I started to look around in my mind's eye at what everyone else is doing. I started looking at friends from school, family friends, university friends, Buddhist friends, you know, all these different heaps of social circles, and trying to think, what are they doing? What's he doing? What are they doing? Oh, they're doing that. Well, do I want to do that? In a sort of panic. And I couldn't find anyone who I admired. I couldn't find anyone who's sort of what they were doing. I thought, oh yeah, that's what I really want to do in this state. And it was just, and then it just sort of went on like this into this large panic where I was basically flung into a nihilistic chaos where nothing meant anything. I'd lost complete confidence in my own ability to go for refuge, you could say. I'd lost a sense of the Dharma, and I couldn't see any other worldly pursuit which I could stomach. So it was terrifying. But what happened was, suddenly, I saw Vidyaruchi. Vidyaruchi was here for the weekend. Suddenly, Vidyaruchi appeared over the other side of my hut, sitting on a chair. And he's a very keen guitarist, and he was sort of sitting there in his sort of guitar posse. He didn't have a guitar. And I just had this, oh, I'm so pleased to see you. Thank God you're here. I've been in a real panic. I don't know what's up or down or whether I'm coming or going. And then, lo and behold, more people flooded into my little hut. I saw friends from all over the place. It's sort of like a... it's all dark, by the way. Completely dark, because my candles have gone out and there's no electricity. And they weren't, these people weren't really there, but it was sort of like a cross between a dream and a vision or an imagination. A bit like a vivid fifth stage of the Metta-Bhavana. So it calmed my nerves, and I didn't, nothing was said. I was just pleased to see him, and then I just fell asleep and woke up the next day feeling bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and the retreat went on. The retreat went on. So what's this got to do with this love as cosmos? Well, I think these words came to mind at that time, because it was as if I didn't know what I was doing, where I was going, what I wanted to do, but at least they were my friends. At least there were these people I cared about. And that all of a sudden changed this chaotic, nihilistic panic into something that had some kind of order, some kind of meaning, some kind of sense. It made sort of a sense of my life. And I realized that that is really an abiding... an abiding truth, that my the love I have for people, the love I have for real people, is what often makes sense of my life, is often what gives my life meaning. It's what stops me feeling like, what's the point in doing this, what I'm doing? So in that sense, I think that's sort of, at least on a personal level, that's what, or an experiential level, something what Paramavaja is getting at. Love is cosmos. Love is that which makes sense of things, the sense of life, or gives life some kind of meaning, some kind of order. And I've been feeling this increasingly, this appreciation for people. I mentioned yesterday when we were in our big lozenge how, I time seems to get quicker. I mean, I'm turning 27 this year, and I've always enjoyed being in company with people, but there's just not enough time to be really in vital contact on a regular basis like that. In London, for example, with most people, meeting up once a week for a drink, I mean, just for a catch up, it's just not enough. This is the reason why I recently moved to work at the London Buddhist Centre. I was very drawn to working in a team. I work in a team of 10 men at the London Buddhist Centre, along with 8 other dharmacharis and some mitras who are training for ordination. We're part of a 17-person team at the centre. But it's just like, I personally absolutely need to be working with people who I'm interested in, who I'm more than just getting along with, but who I'm really... I have a vital contact with a sort of that we're interested in each other's lives, and likewise living in communities. I just live with one other chap at the moment, Mitra training for ordination. But again, even that is something. We have a quite intimate. Living in a two-bed flat is, you know, we see a lot of each other and we take each other in. We spend time together. But the reason why I want to say that is because sometimes it can feel, I think, in the movement that these things like TBRLs, team-based right livelihood, or even communities, are sort of things that you should do. Things that are sort of, there are like ways of working that you should do. And it's easy to forget that actually... It's just a natural response to wanting to be together, you know, wanting to live together, to work together. Work takes up so much time; it really eats into the week. And you know, if you're not doing that with people with whom you can connect with, then that's hard. It's really hard. Likewise, living, we spend a lot of time at home. So again, if it's it's just, for me, it's often just a question of time. I want to be around people who I can have some vital contact with. And I feel more confident, more grateful for that situation now than ever before, particularly after this solitary episode. So just to wrap up, I'm going to offer some conclusions. So some of the things that I've been emphasizing might be would be surprising to some, but they'd certainly probably be surprising if you Wikipedia'd Buddhism and saw that Buddhism was about eradicating desire and getting rid of attachment. And I've just been emphasizing the importance of desire. and rightly so. I think it's such a two-dimensional, naive understanding of desire when people say, oh yeah, just got to sort of get rid of desire, get rid of attachment. I think actually, most of the time, it's more like we're not attached enough, if anything. The issue being, do we really care? Do you really care about things? Do we really care? So much apathy in a way, so much easygoingness, but do we actually care about things? Do we actually care about life and our friends? Do we care about the manifestation of our values? For me, it's in the movement. Do we care about this place? Do I care about the Buddhist Center in London? Do I care about the well-being of the order? So that's one of the questions I want to ask. Are we, in some places, do we care enough? Are we attached enough to things that are worthwhile? But obviously the question is, it depends what, doesn't it? It's always what. It depends what we desire. It depends what we're attached to. And I think the Greeks and the ancient Indians both understood this in both languages, in both Greek and Pali. You don't really get love as an abstract noun. You don't really get love as a sort of thing apart. It depends what the object takes. So they always seem to appreciate that there's this force, there's this response, and that its nature changes depending on the object it attaches to. So for example, in Greek, whether it's the divine or whether it's a friend or whether it's a sexual partner, these are different types of love. And they have different words according. Same way as we have a rich vocabulary in Pali and Sanskrit. Those of you who know the Brahma Viharas, the meditations on love, you know that Maitri love is sort of the awe of love, but it depends. Maitri is what is sort of neutral love when it meets a peer. But when you meet somebody in difficulties, that will turn to Karuna. Or if it's somebody experiencing the fruits of Dharma life, it would be mudita, joyous love. So it changes depending on its objects. So this is important. This is likewise with attachment. It depends what we're attached to. That's probably enough questions, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much, and goodbye.